वाहगुरु जी का खालसा, वाहगुरु जी की फतेह। वेलकम अनमोल।
वाहगुरु जी का खालसा, वाहगुरु जी की फतेह। थैंक्स फॉर हैविंग मी।
सर, रणनीति पंजाब रिटर्न्स अगेन इन हाई कलर्स एंड चढ़ती कला।
Absolutely. That's how it's rolling. That's how we go.
That's how we go, destroying everyone and everything in our way.
We bulldoze, you know?
Yep. We cause chaos, lots of chaos, and there's another chaotic episode lined up, this one.
The unrest is here wherever we step, wherever we look, you know?
Damn, I mean, you can imagine a Punjabi rap star making a rap about that in the future, but I might be getting a bit too ahead of myself here.
I wouldn't see why not.
Anyhow, so welcome back. Good to have you. And today it's going to be another one of those controversial episodes. So get ready for all the threats and praise as usual. You are a historiographer, am I right?
Yeah, that's something I actively partake in proudly, openly. It's something that I think we should all do regardless, right?
Right. So tell us in your own words what historiography is.
So what I've been able to pick up over the years, especially upon just at least first having an introduction to it and eventually going through it through school, is just the study of history. It's what we do, it's what we look at, it's how we're able to take a step back from what we've learned or what we've seen and critique, analyze, judge, determine, right? These sort of things, the settings, what we look at, what sort of sources we take into consideration, why are we looking at this? And then it becomes the basic questions, right? Who wrote this? Why are they writing this? What is the era in which they wrote this in? That all really comes into historiography. It's the study of history flat out. And eventually later on, our process and understanding of it.
So basically, if I was to summarize it, let's say more easily for, you know, listeners like me who might get boomer confused, it's basically the study of how history is made and how we interact with it as the users of history.
Yep, definitely, for sure.
Right. So an example I would like to give you down here, and I think you can relate to it, is that New Zealand recently had a prime minister who I think was a very terrible politician, but okay, I'll keep my political views to myself for this episode at least, Jacinda Ardern. Now, recently I went to the public library, and down there they had two books on Jacinda Ardern. They were both coincidentally written last year. And both were written by university professors. One book is basically how bad Jacinda Ardern was, and the other one is how good Jacinda Ardern was. Now, you as a historiographer say that 2,000 or even 200 years from now, you find these two texts, right? For you, they're historical relics from my time. Now, how do you sort of, you know, reconcile the fact that two texts written at the same time are saying two different things? I mean, how would you as a historiographer describe this situation, but at the same time try providing an answer as to why two different, you know, perspectives of the same person at the same time exist?
What really draws those two in is they're from the same field, right? Two university professors.
Yep.
And that's what definitely would bring things into light as to how we could definitely frame what we're trying to look at exactly. It becomes quite obvious as it really does, is just treading the balance, right? And just discerning. Aside from people tend to look at right versus wrong. It's really just fact and fiction. Right, exactly that. You look at both sources in consideration, and with reference to writing history, right, that what we're looking at now is two biases. You have a bias of, oh, Miss Ardern was good, a bias of, oh, Miss Ardern was bad. So you need to discern exactly what this person is writing. Why are they writing this, right? That all ties back again to historiography and just the study of. So if we want to give the best presentation of myself looking at this 200 years later, is realistically and truthfully to the field itself, it's something I keep very high and important, is academic neutrality and recognizing these biases and really dive deeper and see exactly what they're trying to say, what they're trying to talk about. It is the neutrality. And definitely one thing is to consider is if you're writing this dissection in particular, bring in both views. What is the harm? Bring in the both views and why not add your critique as well?
Right. So if we get to the main gist of what you're saying, it's basically like E.H. Carr describes in What is History? There is no such thing as a neutral historian because history reflects through an individual's mind and their own biases, preconceived notions, even our experiences in life inform how we interact with those events which actually form history.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, I, long story short, I got to the conclusion there is to add in your own thoughts, right? What are you trying to get out of this and what are you trying to present and give your critique? Right, it's exactly that. Carr hit it right on the nail with the hammer. What I'm trying to say.
Yep. So now we come to the more testy subject here, which is, I mean, I would personally say since 2001 there has been this increasing conflict in Sikh Gurdwaras. And okay, so let's go back a little bit in history. You would have heard the name of Gurbakhsh Singh Kalafkhana?
Yeah, it's a name that's popped up from time to time. Not so much in really the mainstream of what Sikh dialogue and throughout really the diaspora really in particular talks about. But it's a name that's came up over the years once in a while. Yeah.
So depending on how you see it, it's either a famous name or a pretty infamous name, but see, personally speaking, I don't agree with the Afkana on many things, but then, like, I did read some of his works. If I find out there's some controversy, I'll always try formulating my own opinion based on, you know, two differing sides to see, you know, which one I find more, you can say, authentic or factual. And that's what we is. That's what also non-Sikhs do. It's just a human tendency. I'm sure you would agree.
Absolutely, yeah, definitely.
And see, I came across his works, and in one of the works he's written this provocative, it starts with a very provocative line that the Khanda, the Bata, the Patase, the Jal does not make you a Sikh. Now, I believe this was the same line which they used to kick him out of the Panth at the Akal Takht. First, they said, we will arrange a video call with him, so, you know, you can present your side of the case. But then they decided at the last minute, well, they said they had a power failure. So whether they actually had a power failure or not is anyone's guess. But if you read ahead in that page where he's written that line, he's actually saying that the Khanda, the Bata, the whole Amrit Sanchar ceremony is a way of being recruited formally into the school of the Khalsa. The Rehet Maryada is as important insofar as it puts you on the basic steps of living the Sikh life. But the ultimate reality, the ultimate goal is to live your daily life as per the Gurbani of Guru Granth Sahib. Now, yeah, you can say he could have put it better, but this whole masla, basically he had been saying this since the late 80s, but the whole problem with him started regarding Gurbilas Patshahi Chevi. And when this was republished around the early 2000s with the support from the Akal Takht, Afghana pointed out some events narrated inside, Guru Har Gobind Sahibji is listening to Sukhmani Sahib, but he's thinking about Bibi Kola in a lustful way, and he decides, okay, look, you know, what stopped the Sukhmani Sahib part? I'm going to go get her. Kola's father insults the Guru, and the Guru says, well, we will see whether I'm your enemy or your Javai. You know, your son-in-law is a way of saying, I'm going to, you know, take your daughter out of your house. Or that, you know, Hanuman's father actually played a role in you know, conceiving Guru Har Gobind Sahib Ji. So there were many such things, but, you know, obviously Harjot Oberoi and the MacLeod Peshwara gang would have argued that this was, you know, Sanatan Sikhi, the pre-colonial Sikhi.
Mm-hmm.
However, the words themselves, the references of Ghana provided left no doubt as to, you know, that the offers of Gur Bilas Patshah Chevi were, you know, in a way, not praising the Guru, but making him look like, you know, any one of the Sanatani avatars with their failings. Now, another thing is, and I'm sure you would agree, these Sikh texts, we really don't know who's written a majority, do we, the ones which are accepted as classic Sikh texts?
All of these grunts in particular, with reference to their authors, have a lot of ambiguity, anonymity, animosity. We really, it's been hard, really it has been, to discern exactly that in the historiographical lens, what these authors are, where these authors are coming from, and what in particular they're trying to achieve, definitely.
So I believe that back in, like, well, okay, so getting back to Afghana, I mean, Akal Takht Jathedar Jugendra Singh Vedanti had a problem with him about this, and, you know, obviously it went into a massive shit show with Afghana getting expelled from the Panth and, you know, becoming even more famous among the fringe. But then from the fringe, he went straight into the mainstream. Like you were saying, the name does pop up occasionally, and now it's popping up with great rapidity.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing is that Afghana actually had a small pamphlet, which I believe he made into a book, but that book hasn't been published yet. And that's that around the 60s or 70s, I believe there was a convention at the Akal Takht where academics decided that, you know, the so-called classic granths we have are raw sources. That is, there is a lot of history there, but it might not be the right history all the way through. I mean, for example, you know, Shri Gur Panth Prakash of Ratan Singh Pangu accuses Baba Banda Singh of being a womanizer, maniac. And then, you know, Pangu is at great pains to sort of reassert that, you know, he became a Gurmukh before he died. Now, Dr. Tillo discovered that by Ratan Singh Pangu's great-grandfather, that was, you know, by Matab Singh's father, had actually played a role in betraying Baba Banda Singh. And Pangu, his disparate treatment of Baba Banda Singh indicates that he wants to tell the truth, but he's also trying to conceal a family history there, right?
Yeah, that comes into the lineage of the Tart Khalsa and Shahid Bhai Mahtab Singh's father, then, of course, having a role throughout the entire revolution. It is the family lineage which then attempts to distort Bhai Ratan Singh Pangu's understanding. And yeah, you're right, he does, if you read through it, really, it's really neatly put in. He really does try to his best to attempt it in the presentation in neutral view, but you do get that sense of what Dr. Tillon was able to come up against, that yeah, there's a little bit of interesting, his mode of presentation is a little bit interesting, and you can definitely pick up on that. Yeah,
right. So you see that a raw source, I'm sure you would agree, would probably be something where, you know, there is a lot of information, but no one has shifted through that information. I mean, I have a friend who works at the University of Washington and not a Sikh. So I did put this entire thing past him, and he told me something interesting, that back in the 60s, there was this massive obsession in America with George Washington, and all the liberals, leftists, and feminists used to criticize George Washington. Because they found documents from the time which said that Washington used to purchase slaves, he used to sell slaves, and that, you know, the impression that was conveyed from these raw sources, which were unstudied or unanalyzed for a better want of term, was that Washington was your typical white slaver. And when they finally sat down in the 80s and 90s to sift through these manuscripts and see what they could, you know, deduce, they actually discovered that there was one more letter, and in that Washington writes to Jefferson, well, can we please get rid of slavery in the United States of America? And Jefferson and Franklin and all these others who were, you know, supporting him at the time told him it's a very dangerous request at the time, because this is a new nation. We're the founding fathers of it. Let's not incite a controversy that can lead to a conflict. And that led many scholars to discover a draft of the Constitution, which actually stipulates that there should be no slavery in the United States. And then they found Washington's will. And in the will, he's basically saying that all the slaves I have, please do not treat them as slaves, even though you can say they're slaves in front of our society, because that society does accept slavery, and I don't want these slaves being persecuted. So at the same time, make sure they're highly educated, they're proficiently fed and kept clean, and they're treated like you would treat my own children. And when they rediscovered all this, there was this massive reclaiming of George Washington, and there was this massive reconciliation with his image. But that only came about because a new narrative was formed from the raw text rather than allowing those texts to dictate the narrative. But unfortunately, what we have at Sikhs today is that many people almost worship the Suraj Prakash and Gurbilas as holy texts, but they're not creating a new narrative from there, a refined narrative. Rather, they're letting those texts and the biases of those authors dictate what Sikhi is. Am I right?
I can't put it in any other better way. Yeah, absolutely. I think Carr had put it really neatly, where he had mentioned that that he was up to date in recognizing that anything written in the 1890s must be nonsense, but not yet advanced enough to be committed to the view that anything written in the 1950s necessarily makes sense. And that is the whole point of looking at these sources as raw. And what you had mentioned there from your friend at the University of Washington in this rediscovering of these Washington era sources is that we're able to now get this new raw information and take a step back and look at what we've done and where we've come as understanding George Washington as a person. And now how can we ourselves obviously transfer that to what we're looking at here as to what we are seeing as raw sources of Gurbilas Patshahi Shemi, Suraj Prakash, Mahima Prakash, anything, right? These are, this has become a bit of a troubling, not so much for Sikh academia in particular, but let's just say a bit of the more religious views that, quote, what is in here is truth, right? And it's something that really cannot be questioned. And if it does end up going to be questioned, then there's a problem and you might not be a Gurmukh of Guru Nanak anymore.
And you see that this might be too late for them, but Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman Bandar, I think that's his name, their new crown prince, he recently released a statement which sent the Islamic world, particularly the Sunni Islamic world, in a furor. Is that the hadiths written 200 years after Muhammad are not considered, in his view, as being authentic, and they need to reclaim Muhammad's life and the Quran from the hadiths. And the thing is that in Islam, if you don't have the hadiths, you don't know what the Quran is saying, essentially. You lose maybe 90% of Islam straight away. But similarly, are we Sikhs running the same danger here if you're prizing these historical texts above the Gurbani of Guru Granth Sahib?
I wouldn't even say we're running the same danger. I really think we're in the pit. It's really as simple as that. When you start to take these historical texts as to what they're supposed to be, historical texts, but then push them forward to really the same reverence as almost Gurbani, you lose the meaning. I say you lose the meaning of what is actually trying to be shared there. And I think Carr had mentioned something along the lines of what the person writing in the present, so at that time, the past, but for them, the present, they expect their work to be superseded again and again and again. And that's what we need to build on as a Panth, as our knowledge. Karam Singh historian would have been writing knowing that eventually then a Bhai Khan Singh Nabba would come to supersede it, whereas then a Dr. Ganda Singh would come to supersede it. And whereas now, of course, we have people, Dr. Chirlochan Singh, Dr. Kripal Singh, whatnot, the late J.S. Garibal, to eventually supersede it. This is growth, right? It's a growth of, it's natural, it's innate nature for us to look back, see of what we have, and then eventually have our basis and further grow on it. It's it's completely natural. But for some reason, the Sangat and the Pant have not caught up to this.
I mean, if we, like, you mentioned Dr. Ganda Singh, and in the If Can Seek episode, I did Dr. Joginder Singh Tej Khurana recalls how Dr. Ganda Singh visited Afghanistan, but he, you know, did not see many historical beers of the Guru Granth Sahib, or that, you know, famous Hukamnama, which mentions the 5 Ks, mm-hmm. or these other Hetnamas written personally by Guru Gobind Singh to the Afghan Sikhs. Anyway, mm-hmm. they have them in India and UK now because they are obviously moving out of Afghanistan. So, you know, by each other failing with the Taliban. But then, mm-hmm. like you were saying, superseding in growth, Dr. Ganda Singh actually dismissed the Hukamnama as being, you know, speculative. But then you see Gobind Singh Mansukhi came along and confirmed it was authentic. So you have this growth mentality going on. However, when you mention the growth mentality, what I see is that, you know, Tadis, Ragis, even, you know, typical Sikhs, they will say that, you know, we are talking with the authority of Dr. Ganda Singh's works. Is this actually right, or are they failing to see that even Ganda Singh was fallible in a way?
Well, they're all really fallible in a way. I mean, you take a look at this, reminds me now of, well, we have, right, the in a previous podcast that you had of the Persian sources and the Mughal Darbar court records on the Shahidi of Nome Patsha, Guru Tegh Bahadur Sahib. And, yep. Right, these right, like Kavi Santokh Singh, Nihang Pai Ratan Singh Pangu, they would not have had access to Muhammad Kasim's Ibratnama or Rai Surjan Pandari's Khulasat Uttawark, right? So yep. it's all infallible in a way, really. And there again, it comes to one's judgment and understanding of historiography as to what can I posit here as fact, what can I posit here as fiction? Then later goes on to, what can I posit here as right? What can I posit here as wrong? It's really nuanced.
Right, but that's not to say that it's entirely fallible, but there are some parts which, you know, require updating, obviously, after time. I mean, before Dr. Tillo discovered the documents, you know, citing that Binod Singh betrayed Banda Singh, Dr. Ganda Singh explained it away, saying that, well, you know, Binod Singh had a disagreement and he left. And before that, we see Pai Veer Singh dismissing that this might have happened altogether, just saying that Pangu is trying to explain something that happened before his time with, you know, the logic he was using. So in your work, when have you actually ever come up against Sangat who's been hostile to such critique?
I could say I have, both in person and online. And it's, once again, it's just the Sangat stuck in that sort of mentality. I know, especially here in the scene in particular across the greater Toronto area, it's really, especially in the diasporic youth, it comes up to Jathebandi and who you're associated with. And it comes as kind of a shock or maybe a step back to most people that I say, hey, I'm just a normal Keshtari Singh of the Sarbat Khalsa. I don't form with really any Jathebandi. I'm really on the heavy lenient on the academic side. And I try to work into conversations for Sangat to really pick up on that sort of, hey, let's, you know, while we're praising and looking at, let's say, Siddhi Gurpat Prakash or Gurpratap Suraj Prakash, let's take a step back and let's try and at least understand where was the author coming from. And to even mention just a basic understanding of critique there, I get kind of side eyes and weird looks. So not something that I'm not used to, but it's definitely evident and it is a thing amongst the Sangat for sure.
So before we discuss how to change this mentality, how did this mentality, do you think, start? Because, I mean, personally speaking, I wasn't born in the 80s, to be honest. I wasn't born before the 80s. I was born in the 90s. So I remember, you know, elders at home talking, you know, they were with Sant Jarnail Singh Ji. They were in the Kisan Unions and he used to come and meet them. They had a lot of time for him. But over time, I mean, even today, my grandfather remembers he actually fought his way over from Pakistan, Lailpur, back in the 40s. And he remembers that 50s onwards, you had Gyani, Gyan Singh Radewala, Kartar Singh, you know, who used to translate English and French, even Spanish and Russian works into Punjabi and, you know, Gurmukhi for the common masses. So in a way, Sikhs had a lot of access to information from other perspectives, other languages, and their own language and their, you know, own script. But since the 80s, he believes that, you know, individuals with vested interests or a fanatical streak have hijacked the image of Sant Jarnail Singh. And why I'm saying this is that since the past few years, there's been massive controversy over the Suraj Prakash Granth. And we can see that, you know, Puneet Sahani, that idiot, brought up this thing again, that Harinder Singh Chopra found two authentic manuscripts of the Shri Guru Panth Prakash, which mention, you know, Pang Sukha Guru Gobind Singh Ji manifesting Devi Guru Nanak being a descendant of Raja Janak. Except those two manuscripts, I believe, are in Chandigarh and they're still undated. Even Chopra was unable to date them. So all the dated manuscripts we have, all 20 of them, say something else. Regarding the Suraj Prakash, you do have commentary by Veer Singh, by, you know, Dr. Ajit Singh Olak, I believe you have commentary by the SUPC. But then suddenly some individuals are claiming that just because Sant Jarnail Singh Ji used to do katha from it, it means Kavi Santokh Singh was pure and pious. And if he's saying that Baba Ram Rai was born because Guru Harai had an affair, or Guru Gobind Singh Ji could not wake up without, you know, intoxicating himself on afim every morning, it should be all right and all authentic. Now, how would you deal with that situation when they bring in a figure like Sant Ji in here?
That comes on to, yeah, exactly that, the critique of then you're now, right, you're challenging what's been the established narrative. And it's something that's always been frowned upon since the Sangha's been establishing this sort of view. In particular, for me, let's say bringing up Sant Ji, of course, I myself am from his village anyways. But nevertheless, there is this belief that, which I do hold on to. I do hold on to a good extent, is the Puran Mahapurkh or the Brahmgyani. They have an elevated understanding of which the commoner, like myself, would not be able to get to. And although it could be true, as we may not have that avastha, but it's just in my nature, for me in particular, to just take a look at it academically and just and be critical as to what we're looking at. And it may not even be so much as to what is presented, but more so of what is in turn then being used to present, or what is being used from internally to then give this sort of or push on a new idea or narrative. So if we were to take a look at, let's say, for pursuing a katha on, let's say, Suraj Prakash, or exactly that would just be narrating exactly what each pankti says and understanding. You just get the basic idea. Let's say if you were to hear a kathavachik start rambling in a gurdwara, but you want to, what you really need to do is listen and really see exactly what is being presented. And we don't get that sort of, we don't get that justice as to one giving an explanation of exactly what the author he was trying to say, where that author is coming from, right? I've heard kathas of Santji where he had mentioned, where he had critiqued Kavi Santokh Singh and mentioning this, oh, the author may have understood it this way. The author may have been a more controversial one that I've heard, which some sections don't agree with, is the author may have been an addict of the narcotic, right? Therefore, he would write this and Guruji would not permit Singhs to consume said narcotic. So the Sampradayic tradition is not one to break. I personally believe there is value in it there, but you should be able to challenge and you should be able to question, not even so much more challenge. You should be able to question. And if it leads to things being overturned or at least presenting a new understanding, which could shed more light on what we're trying to get at, by all means, I'm for it.
Right, so when we look at this critique, I mean, so even Santji was, you know, basically critiquing, which is something that is not allowed today. And I suppose if he had been here today, they would even try silencing him by saying, well, you can't critique this, blah, 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 blah. But are these critiques valid? I mean, if you look at it from, for example, you know, I won't name any names, but there is the famous pseudo-scholar who claims that he's found some lost granths and that pre-colonial times, the Shabad from Guru Granth Sahib on Shrab was understood very differently to how it's understood today. So when you look at such mental acrobatics like that, and then you look at the Guru Granth Sahib, I mean, I personally believe that, you know, words have power and that there's no postmodernist thing that, you know, words have changed meanings or anything. So when you look at that critique, if that critique is based off Guru Granth Sahib, do you believe that critique is essentially valid? Because, you know, let's get back to Kabir Santokh Singh. Some of these Granths say that the Gurus were, you know, addicts themselves. Do we actually believe that, or is it the author writing that to justify their own patron's conduct or their own conduct overall? So are these critiques valid in light of Gurbani?
It boils down to one's understanding and what they really want to see as truth or not, which then eventually goes on to, oh, feeling over fact, which is never, ever the case. The biggest thing that I do believe Carr does go on to discuss as well is you want to take a look at the gap of which when the source was written and where what the source is trying to write about, right? I'd always mentally procured this sort of list just to try and get listeners and just Sangat in general an understanding of where I'm coming from. So, for example, we have a short poem, Var Amrit Sarki, written by one Pai Darshan Pagat. And what that entails is written sometime around March to April 1709. And it happened to have been two Mughal officers from Patti, I believe one was Hindu as well, who led an attack against Harmandir Sahib to take back debts. Now, this comes 6 months after Shahenshah Guru Gobind Singh returned to Sachkhand, right?
Yep.
So, if I'm saying you want to get an understanding of a mentality or what you want to place yourself in those shoes, you look at the oldest. And you really can get something there. This is 6 months. So there's value. There's something there. There's something by Darshan Pagat trying to say. Siri Gur Sobha by Kavi Chandra saying Senapati, 1713. Right? That's 5 years after Guruji returned to Sachkhand. Right? Yep. Then you push on to the Gurbalas series, let's say by Ker Singh, the historian, 1751, I believe. That goes on to almost half a century. We have Mehma Prakash by Surup Das Palla, 68 years now later, in 1776, right? And then, of course, the penultimates, we have Pant Prakash Ratan Singh Pangu, 133 years after Guruji returned to Sachkhand, and then Suraj Prakash by Kavi Santokh Singh, now 135 years after Guruji returned to Sachkhand. You need to take a look at where the era in which these are placed in, what they're coming from, what are they trying to write and prove in the era in which they are writing in, right? So there may have been, for let's say, Kavi Santokh Singh in particular, holding up this sort of idea, holding up this sort of translation through a different lens, i.e. we know he was coming from Nirmala school, so let's just put out there a Vedantic lens, right? These are things we need to keep in mind. And I might be rambling now, but it's just something that I always try and urge to the Sangat, even if I may not be getting the point across, is we need to look at what we're trying to understand here and why we can't continue. Why can't there be another a series of a Prakash that could come out now, and why can't we look at that as truth, as how much it's really grown on the tradition and what it's passed on, and critique and lens and everything I'd mentioned earlier of determining and whatnot. But that might be what I'm trying to get at there.
Right. So, for example, there is a part in the Suraj Prakash, and this is something which, you know, postmodernists essentially love to argue that words have changed meanings. And then you have the Hindus and Muslims jumping in on this as well to, you know, put down Sikhs. But there's a part where Guru Tegh Bahadur says to Aurangzeb that I'm a Hindu, I'm not going to leave my Hindu Dharam. But then you look at the Gurbani of Guru Arjan, which says, "Na ham Hindu, na Musliman." You know, we're neither Hindus nor Muslims. How would you, like, I mean, which perspective, Gurbani's perspective or the Suraj Prakash's perspective, which one takes high priority over here, especially if there is katha being done in the Gurdwara?
Especially even too when there's katha being done in the Gurdwara in the presence of Sri Guru Granth Sahib Ji, it is the Guruji, it is the Guru Granth Sahib that comes on top. And I've heard exactly what you've mentioned. I've heard that many times before. Propagandists, especially the Hindutva extremists, will mention it, that for somehow, somewhere out of the blue, that Guru Tegh Bahadur had told Aurangzeb, it is my Hindu dharma. No clue where this comes from, right? Because this is another thing I mention a lot, and it should kick gears and start get people to think. I'd also made a post about this on Vaisakhi, think of it this way. Guru Nanak founded the Khalsa Panth on that fateful day in 1699.
Yep.
So for some listeners, what I'm trying to get at is that we know actively in Gurmukh that Guru Gobind Singh is Guru Nanak. What I'm trying to say is the next roops that came on after, it is the same person. It is the same Jot. It is all Guru Nanak. Like what you had mentioned, right? How
yep.
Guru Arjun Sahib says, there's no, I'm not Hindu, I'm not Muslim. That's just Guru Nanak in his fifth form speaking, right? So yep. So really looking through the Gurmukh lens, which is up on top, right?
Yep.
You're not going to have another lens that comes in and critiques this. It just doesn't make sense. It just does not make sense for a Gurmukh, for a Sikh to do. But if you have Guru Nanak in his fifth form saying that, I am neither Hindu nor Muslim, but then out of nowhere, another source outside of Guru Nanak in his 11th form, the Guru Granth Sahib, saying that Guru Nanak in his 9th form, as Guru Tegh Bahadur, had told Emperor Aurangzeb that it is my Hindu dharma that sustains me. It just does not make sense. I'm always baffled by that.
So when we do look at that, like, so that raises two questions down here. So, you know, initially, when Bhai Veer Singh had his first edition of the Panth Prakash published, that edition of the Panth Prakash met with a lot of criticism because it turned out he had a damaged manuscript. And he would later explain in later editions that finally he was told where more authentic manuscripts are. And he finally concluded after a comparative analysis that the initial manuscript he used was a later day interpolation.
Mm-hmm.
So that brings us to the first question, is that when we have texts like Gurbilas and Suraj Prakash, all these historical grants, and this is what Dr. Till always emphasizes as well, has there ever been any attempts made to find the originals? Or is it that just because, you know, so-and-so Babaji used it, we are going to use it as well blindly?
I can't be so sure on the Granth series in particular, right? We have Panth Prakash and Suraj Prakash. They've always been stuck in that sort of limbo as to original manuscript, where are they coming from? I know particularly I had been studying the Janam Sakhis a lot, and that too comes of my critique of, and understanding really extrapolation of what Sant Sayed Pratipal Singh and his work, which was released by the family in 2018 on Tajuddin Naqshbandi's manuscript of what Guruji had done in Makkah, Medina, Baghdad, so on. In particular of that pursuit of looking to where the Janamasakis come from, you know, you have one saying that Apai Sevadas had this written in this sort of year, 1638, whatnot. I'm just putting that out there, I can't say. But we have a manuscript then coming from 1732 in particular, which have been dated, right? So as in terms of the Granth series that we have here, Panth Prakash, Suraj Prakash, Mehma Prakash, whatnot, there have been at times, many times, where people have tried to, scholars have tried to look into where this dating comes from, but it's been I want to say personally, from my understanding, a downhill battle. We just can't put a nail on it. We really don't know.
So, like, when you say we can't put a nail on it, is it because there is this apathy among the Panth that we should not be putting a nail on it because we will be wounding sentiments of the Sampradas? Or is it just a lack of resources and the environment that we are confronting at the moment, both politically and socially in India?
More former, there is really this sort of tie that, yes, we don't want to break sentiments. More so, we don't want to break what's already established. But the problem is that if we have something that's somewhat flawed, that is established, this isn't a right mode. This isn't a right way in which the punt is then really dealing with our understanding of history right now. And it comes to a point where, and it is a reality, is then you start looking at external sources, like I had mentioned, right? Appai Ratan Singh or Kavi Satok Singh would not have had access to, Kafi Khan's Ibratnama or anything, right? So by the point that where we are today, we should be able to, like I keep saying, it's just true though, take a step back, right? Look at around at what other sources of even externals of what have been looking at us. But a lot of people like to look at Dabistani Mazhab, reportedly, they say written by a Zoroastrian author, but nevertheless, it is that point where it's the former out of what you had mentioned, is just to not break sentiments. But the problem is that if we don't have an understanding of where we're headed, what are these sentiments really, if not just that, sentiments, and not a concrete established foundation?
Right. So the second question this begs, obviously, and this is something that's related to another story I'd like to recall, is have you heard about Nidar Singh Nihang?
Yes. Yes, I have. Definitely a topic that has come up and around, and I'll have my comments reserved for now. But if we want to delve into it, by absolutely all means.
I mean, when you learn several different martial arts, mix them together, claim you have got some ancient Shastra Vidya, and first you market it as Chatka Gatka, then Shastra Vidya, then Khalsa Shastra Vidya, then Sanatan Sikh Hindu Shastra Vidya, you're evolving over time. Mm. But minus his messy divorce case, one thing which I noticed was that him and Nihang Teja Singh, no one has seen this Nihang Teja Singh as far as I can see. And so this elusive Nihang Teja Singh built a website called Sarblo.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
I actually tracked down some sources which Sarblo used. So they were basically, regurgitating some cherry-picked quotes anyway. And one of the interesting things I noticed was that, Gyani Kirpal Singh Ji, who was, I believe, the Jathedar of Akal Takht when Operation Blue Star occurred.
Yeah, yeah.
Gyani Kirpal Singh was actually quite a big scholar because he basically branched the gap between the missionary school of thought, which was, based on rationalism derived from Gurbani, but also the Sampradayak, which was more, Vedantic. But, he was actually one of the few scholars who did re-authenticate Principal Sarbir Singh's research that Sai Mia Mir never laid the foundation stone of Darbar Sahib, that, maybe Sai Mia Mir's role is overblown. And, Gyani Kirpal Singh provided this critique, this commentary, but also a revised edition of Gyani Gyan Singh's Shri Gur Panth Prakash, Navin Panth Prakash, I believe.
Yeah.
And in the Navin Panth Prakash, I think it is that or the Tuarik Guru Khalsa, but I'm still going towards Navin Panth Prakash, is that he provided a little commentary that lots of people came to me and said that I need to change some of Gyani Gyan Singh's words to make the, Navin Panth Prakash more palpable, more accurate. And I refuse to do this because you should not be touching historical granths, because if you tamper with their authenticity as far as their writers are concerned, then you set a precedent which can go against you. And I'm sure you can appreciate that as a historiographer.
I do, definitely. Yeah, that it does make sense as to exactly you're not tampering with what we have. It is important to preserve. I respect and I do admire his decision definitely for doing that. It is one thing to preserve, but I do still stand once again. It is a different thing to critique and outright, as we have this Naveen Panth Prakash, Suraj Prakash, Prachin Panth Prakash. These are only historical texts. We have come to this point to virtually worship them and hold them above water to the point where they reach almost the palki of Guru Granth Sahib, right? It's just not there. And if Gyani Kirpal Singh Ji Jathedar had reached that conclusion, but had also gone on to critique, that is more than welcome. And that should be more than implored and allowed. I don't even think a Jathedar should be at that position. I really think any Gurmukh who wants to know what they're practicing and what they've done, what the Panth is, should be allowed to do that.
Yep, I'm agreed down there with you. So Gyani Kirpal Singh made that statement, and Nidar and company took that and pasted it up with this very, very subjective translation to claim that, you know, Sikhi is Sanatan, Gyani Gyan Singh realized Sikhi is Sanatan. But as Gyani Kirpal Singh says, many of the Singh Sabha Sikhs want to change that. Totally out of context. Totally out of context. If you look at Gyani Kirpal Singh's original words, original critique, and the cherry picking they did. However, that begs this question, and it's two-sided. So should these Granths, with their failings, be promoted in Guru Ghars? Because this was Afkhana's problem as well. That what happens the day when these Granths start being used as mediums of, you know, translations for translating and understanding Gurbani, or they start being used as the basis for creating a new Rehth Maryada? So should these Granths be promoted in Gurdwaras, or should they be critiqued and then used to formulate a new narrative, which is, you know, less poetic but more accurate for, you know, narrating Katha in Gurdwara?
I don't necessarily hold a problem still in maybe a Kathavachik using a Granth or so. Of course, here in the diaspora, we're just so fixated on this Suraj Prakash that I really can't even say the last time I've heard even a Katha of Panth Prakash. Never ever heard one of Mahima Prakash. But in terms of having them, at least for discussion, you know, that actually reminds me of one point where I remember hearing some Singhs talking about how at the time of the Harmandir Sahib, where the daily Hukamnama would have been read around Guru Arjan Sahib and Guru Hargobind Sahib's time when Baba Buddha Ji was the head Granthi, right? After the Hukamnama would have been read, the Sangat would have, either inside of the Darbar Sahib or outside in the premises of what is now the Parkarma, would have sat down and actually discussed and talked about, okay, what does the Hukamnama say today? What are we trying to get? What is Guruji trying to tell us today, right? And we don't get that at Gurdwaras. We just have the Kathavachik sitting and telling us, right? Explanation here, maybe no dialogue, of course. Then plays into your second part, which I'm aware many times happened throughout the 50s into the 70s and even the 80s, as to where taking an Athiyasik Granth and sitting down, Sarbat Khalsa, anything really, any modes of any Jathebandis or Sampradayas with academics and whatnot, sitting down, facing ourselves as the Panth and asking us, what do we have here? And what can we gain from it? But also, and this is important questions that they did ask back then, what have we learned since that this Granth may not cover? And that is a reality, right? Of what they would have been talking about, because that is the critique. And I think really, I've been telling so many people, especially people who have messaged me over the past months, really, we may really, in fact, be in need of a Singh Sabha Lahir 2.0 based on where we've come and why we're just so fixated on revering these next Granths as Gurbani.
I definitely agree with you, and we are pushing for Singh Sabha 2.0, but unfortunately, we are confronting a lot of problems, particularly with boomer Sikhs. But hey, brother, I'm sure we will triumph when Sikhs start listening to these episodes, like what you're saying at the moment, and our youth start taking initiative for themselves. So, you know, Guru Maharaj, keep us in Chardiglan. None of us should lose heart. Mm-hmm. But you bring up that point about these, you know, almost mini Sarbat Khalsas in Sangats every day where everyone could sit down. So who would facilitate these discussions? The Granthi Singh? And how would the Sangat approach it? Like, would it be everyone shouting over each other, or just the people who knew what they were talking about, or the normal Sangat? I mean, how would this go?
It could be all over, really. I mean, when you get to, especially in diasporic understanding, when you get to the point where a Kathavachik is being asked a question which they may have not studied, like, let's say, anything really along the lines of just the Western rationality, or is God benevolent or omnipotent, and they're not in a position to give an answer, that is a reality out here that would stray away from the sort of understanding that we're trying to get at. And even more so, where we have Sangat and whatnot getting together and having sort of discussions, which I wholly promote. But the thing is to break barriers. And I know, especially in diaspora, where it could be so fixated on this Sampradaya, that Jathebandi, and I'm not a liar in any of those. I really do, of course, try to follow at least the basics of what I can get to when it comes to Sikhi and Rayat and whatnot. An unbiased path. I know it's a little bit difficult for maybe some people to hear me say, coming from Road Day especially. But nevertheless, I really think that's the path of true understanding, not for self, not just for self, but Panth as a whole, because that's what it really boils down to. We are a Panth as a whole. And if outsiders are allowed to pick out this old manuscript of a Granth that would have said this and that, and then question us and have us, we're bouncing around and not able to really get to where we want to go. How can we internally look amongst ourselves and say, yeah, we're perfectly fine in a good position as to where we are right now, right?
Definitely, definitely. I mean, this is something based on a few personal incidents I've had as well, as that, you know, many of our kids are turning towards atheism. Most people are fixated on Christian conversions, Islamic conversions of Sikhs by force, but you look at the reality, atheism is just around the corner. It's growing globally and becoming a rapid danger, and we still haven't woken up to it. But the advice I received from Dr. Gurnam Singh, who used to work for Akal Jinnah, was that, you know, have this Goshti session with children, a learn and go, where they come and interact with you and ask you questions, and, you know, like what you were saying, essentially. That said, however, does that also require the attention of the normal Sangat as well? Because, I mean, if you look at, I mean, today I went to the Gurdwara and I swear that 80% of the Sangat was only there for pakori. So how, like, does it sort of require interest in the first place, or could it just be that a conversation starts and then everyone just jumps in as per their wish?
It really does require for us, in both short and long term, a space. And that's where really the diaspora has really come to. The Gurdwara is a space where we're able to do these sort of things. I have Sikh friends all across the spectrum, from near atheism to just Sahajdari to I'm with this Sampradaya or Jathebandi. So it's really unique, and it's very helpful to get all these sort of perspectives. And especially when, as you'd mentioned, the Sahajdari atheist sort of lens, getting those inputs and those sort of point of views. Like you mentioned, pakore, I've heard people tell me we need sports complexes to have the Sangat active, which I agree. It's good. It follows along the lines of, like we said, Guru Nanak in his second form promoting Akhara wrestling, right? Yep. Nevertheless, we need a really basis on what a Gurukar can provide and what the Sangat knows that is available there. You'd mentioned also spontaneous sort of conversations and having just people come around who are around and get into it. That's good too. It's healthy. May not be directed or sort of controlled at all, but which could have, of course, lead to the good old fights, the Gurdwara fights. But nevertheless, it's really so just trying to get people out there. And I was having this conversation literally with the president of my local Gurdwara here, and he was hammering it home is that we're not in a position right now where we can have youth in particular come out and do something, learn something even too, in particular, as my proposal was to get sort of history seminars going in the local Gurdwara and what we can present. And it's really just that is, what can we do to keep youth around to crush out the atheism, even if not so much the reaches of Christianity or Islamic conversion, right? It's just that it's strains my mind sometimes trying to get on that is how we can cover this.
I mean, that's how Dr. Gurnam Singh and the others managed to turn this insidious grooming gang. Basically, before the technical difficulty, I was saying that that's how they turned that insidious grooming gang wave on itself back in England in the 80s and 90s. But no, I understand what you're saying. So one thing which has always come up even here is that we have building spaces for Gurdwaras worth $2 million, but we only seem to be opening them for Pakore on Saturdays and Sundays. And I've personally been trying to get history classes and even kickboxing classes going at the Gurdwara, but we're just coming up against this massive wall that the people who can get the money are straightforward boomers, you know, with their lack of vision and myopia, whereas the people who want to do it have this generational conflict with them. And I understand what you mean. So is there any history we can use to reinstall that original Sangat system?
There is history there, definitely, with trying to create a basis as to how this Sangat system really works. It revolves around what came into later Sakya, which I know one, I believe the Akhand Kirtan Jatha may still use, the Panj Pyare system. And just having a Sangat in a position to lead, this may be off track, but it is somewhat related. I know there's a Gurdwara right now out in Fraser Valley, British Columbia, Canada. It is Gurdwara Kalgidar Darbar, and right now it's the Sangat that are leading a huge charge against the committee there in particular, which stems from a few weeks ago now, that the Gurdwara had thrown out in the dumpster a lot of Guru Theosic important things, such as Nanak Shahi calendars, tea, even a kirpan, and whatnot that they did not need. And of course, the solution there would have been that the Sangat is promoting now online is an Agni, and just to cremate it sort of in a saskar way if you really don't need it. And it's the reclamation of these spaces. And I know the Meaty Piri Foundation too had touched upon it. It's that as Sangat, how do we hold these spaces? I know at that Gurdwara in particular, right now, their security, there are people of the Sangat who have been banned outright by the committee that cannot come through and hold these meetings, which they are holding these Sangat-led meetings. And it breaks that structure, of course, that we have these Bujurgs and the elders, however old they are, running the Gurdwara still from whenever they came, they immigrated and settled in their countries. It goes against that, but it's just a reality that that system is not going to stay for long. I sent them an email. Two of the committee members, the committee leads there at the Gurdwara Kalgidar Darbar, that, hey, like, I just told them, hey, this is, you're fighting against a reality in which you're not going to be here for long. It is a reality, and to the point where the youth are going to come in and they're going to install these Sangat-led systems. However affected they may be, you might as well step out now and just let it happen instead of denying the inevitable.
I think our people have this thing, you know, when they're so defeated and thrashed that we need to avoid conflict. But that's a dangerous mentality because conflict is good. And I'm not saying that because, look, the last thing I want is people to say, hey, Amarjeet on the Sikh Renaissance said conflict is good. Let's go beat up the committee. No, don't do that. But don't avoid conflict when it comes. Just jump straight into the fray passionately.
Yeah, it's the politics, right? As we know, I was just explaining to someone earlier in the day, that right, we're political. We have to be. It's one of Guruji's bainties, right, to the pant, to the Sangat, that hey, you know the Guru Nanak said, you live the householder's life, you engage in politics. And I know it can be argumental, and it's a reality as to how feelings flare up, but that's just how we are as a pant, right? It's pant before self. And I'm gonna say it again, take a step back and look at where we are right now, and what are we gaining as a Sangat, as a Pant together? Where are we headed, right? And if it needs to be argumentative, so be it. And it's just a reality. It's our politics. It's the meaty, peaty side of what we're trying to get at. We all care for each other. We really do. It's not that we don't. We all wish the best for each other. And as the entire Sangha Panth, we're all well if we do well.
I mean, one of the things I've had is like children question me, is that who died and gave pais the authority to dictate the Gurdwara structure? But then you look at it, it's the committees pushing the pais. I mean, I'll be honest with you today. I was sitting at the back cutting the receipts for donations, and the pais is sitting at the front smashing out Waheguru, Waheguru, Waheguru. The screen's got Waheguru written on there. Some of the BBs are going Waheguru, Waheguru, Waheguru. The men are just looking at each other, looking at their watches, looking at the Gurdwara clock, imagining all the roti and paneer they're going to get. And the kids at the back are literally swearing at the pai in English, but, you know, mm-hmm. us trying to keep them down. But then I had this, you know, feeling in my mind that how do you even engage people? You know, I mean, the pai sitting at the front doing his stuff, and then later he will ask me, well, you know English, you're from here, why aren't the kids listening to me? Well, you're not really providing anything for the kids to listen to, are you? I mean, yeah, it's all well and good doing kirtan, but kirtan should be followed by vichar. And I think that comes back to this thing all over again, that when committees realize that there is a lack of vichar, the sangat might be, you know, in danger of going somewhere else, the money in the golak is going to deplete, let's get in one of those sampradayak pais who can relate some ithihasik granth, and that's it. You know, we can claim brownie points for that. But the true essence, the true vichar of where we want to be, what we need to learn, and, you know, refining our narratives, clearing up our narratives, that never happens because there's so much sentimentality attached with our past relics. And I'm not saying we need to destroy them. It's just that don't worship them, at least. Because, you know, history reflects through an historian's mind. And aren't we in danger of making the same mistakes as those historians and how they see the world around them if we start worshiping them?
We are. It's just a simple reality as to that. Whatever this Granth may have been saying at that time, we're going to look at it now and all of a sudden say, yeah, that is the time. And that's where we need to hold on to that grip and never let go. It's about relating. And yeah, you had mentioned about the prachar, of course, and the kids and what's being presented. I myself, a big personal experience for the longest time, I never even knew what the Kathavachik was talking about half the time until recently, in the few years, probably about 2014-15 onwards, I actually sat down and something clicked in my head that, hey, he's actually talking about something here. And but that might not be for everyone, right? That's not everyone, especially for the diaspora. That might not be the mode. And especially if one Sampradayak Kathavachik is coming in saying that, another Jathebandi man is coming in saying that. My biggest goal here really has been, and we've gained a lot of progress actually recently, and so much so that it might happen, is to go around and just have these sort of history sessions, maybe, you know, every other week or so, and appeal through it through the academic lens. Of course, you're using the Western lens, but have it retuned so that the kids, and at least the nojamans, the teens, the preteens, can come in and say, hey, I'm actually gaining something here. It's worthwhile to come here. And let them leave from that and then sit in the darbar and connect the dots as to, oh, Kathavachik is mentioning something this here. Oh, I picked up on this pankti here in this kirtan, in this shabad, right?
Yep, definitely. And another thing I'd like to add in here is you said Western lens. Now, there are many scholars like Jawala Singh who will say, well, hey, we had a pre-colonial, pre-Western lens, but none of them are able to actually define what that lens was. And the Western lens at least works. We don't even know whatever lens was to start with. So why not use the best tool available at the moment?
Yeah, and you can also use that lens to look back in time. And like you said, we don't know what that lens was. Maybe so that said lens may have never existed, right? What I've always tried to maintain this balance, and it is doable. You maintain the balance between the Western, you know, academic lens, the mode of history, along with Gurmat. It's not too hard. It may be nuanced in some areas. But when you have this Western lens that's been tried and tested and it hasn't failed yet, and you can you use that to understand Sikhi, and I've never had any difficulty up until this point from my personal experience, where using the Western lens has then later challenged the Gurmukh and made me question Gurmukh. I've never gotten to that point yet. We know Gurmukh's on top, and that's our lens anyways. But using this sort of next, as you'd mentioned, this next historical lens that never existed. Well, I mean, you look at Gurdas Varan by Jathedarbhai Gurdas Ji. It's just narration. I really don't see... I haven't picked up yet on a personal sort of lens that he's trying to put through. It's his narration, it's understanding, it's the history, right? And we look at that through the Western lens and say, yeah, Jathedarbhai Gurdas Ji is saying this, he's saying that, it adds up here, it makes sense there. It's tried and tested, and it's still stood true, and it's never compromised my understanding for Sikhi and for Guruji's Gurmukh. So I really don't see, even going into the future, why it would and why change it.
That's right. I mean, I think most of these scholars are just trying to make a quick buck over, you know, this unnecessary controversy or Western lens, pre-colonial lens, etc. I mean, it's come to a point where some of these feminists are saying that modesty is not a Sikh concept. And I asked one of them, so what, in pre-colonial terms, we were all going fully naked, and I got blocked. But you sort of see where the stupidity leads you down to. It leads you to a slippery slope of ridiculousness where there is no limit to how low you can fail in the first place.
Yeah, exactly that. It's exactly that.
Anyhow, on the historiography side of things, do you believe there is a difference now being made, or do we still have a lot of time to go before we actually climb out of the pits we have dug ourselves into?
No, I do believe there is some work that needs to be done. I can't necessarily say in particular, as much as I'd paid attention, that we've may have even started to work towards it yet. There was this project that I did want to do, and I know I'm going to get to it, is to I am trying to get a physical copy. I'm returning to Punjab soon, and I'm trying to get physical books and recensions, really, of anything, right? Whether Paisa by Veer Singh had done, or maybe Paisa by Randhir Singh, this exegesis on Suraj Prakash and whatnot. And I'm trying to take a look at all of it, and really just trying to tie it all into, of course, what is Kavi Santokh Singh saying here? What is Bhairat Singh Pangu saying there? Why did these people then pull out this and that? Why were they able to say this? It's a start. And I really do think that if not, of course, you're not writing it down into a book format or anything, really. You should do mentally. Every Sikh should do mentally. And you should see a lot of progress from it. I had mentioned earlier, right, that... it is the progress that we get from, you know, of course, let's say a Kavi Santokh Singh to then a Gyani Gyan Singh, to then a Karam Singh historian, whatnot. It's all progress, right? And they may have these sort of nuanced things that they say here and there. They wouldn't have had access to something that would have furthered deepened our understanding there. And to much credit as to the historians and whatnot that we have now, I really want to give to, you know, doctors such as, you know, Balwant Singh Dhillon, or even a J.S. Garewal, the late Dr. Narendra Singh Kapani, right? All these sort of peoples who Jathebandis, they present a bias in their understanding. I personally may hold some above others, right? Rightfully so. But I've yet to see a fault in the Sikh academic understanding too, and it's not obviously pursued in our local gurdwaras here, especially amongst the diaspora, of course, online, this Instagram page, that Instagram page, this whatnot, but it's a start, at least in those said circles, as to what we're trying to get at, and let's see if we can push it out.
Yeah, I suppose so, because a few years ago I met Harjinder Singh Majhi, and I did have a talk with him regarding all this. And he told me that, you know, at the end of the day, these texts need to be refined definitely. Maybe they need to be taken off the market and just, you know, exclusively used for academic purposes. And that said, though, you know, end of the day, take the good and leave the bad, because, you know, we all agree that the gurus weren't Amlis, like, you know, Santokh Singh has presented them, but then he's actually typecasting the aristocrats of his times and probably trying to justify their conduct. If I remember correctly, Carr mentions Goethe, who was a German, I believe, who actually wrote a history of Athens. And when he's discussing the Athenians, especially their, you know, conquering expeditions, like they had a pretty impressive navy in their heyday, he's usually at odds to describe how Athenians, like he, you know, obviously exaggerates elements of Athenians having dialogues among themselves that, you know, are we doing the right thing? Is what we are doing right by destroying a civilization or, you know, subjugating it and bringing it to our, you know, perspectives, our way of life? And, you know, Carr describes this because around Gough's time, Britain was slowly beginning to erode its colonial power. And, you know, the British, obviously, on the street were always wondering that, you know, is colonialism right? Are we doing the right thing? So in a way, you can see how people typecast the realities of their day onto the history they're writing, especially historians. And you can see that maybe Santokh Singh did this as well, that, you know, he was trying to typecast the aristocrats as patrons onto the gurus to justify their conduct, even though he was taking a massive creative license. But then these are the sort of things we need to pick up and, you know, discard and leave the good behind to, you know, sort of bring out this narrative, because generation to generation, century to century, countries and peoples always update their narrative. I'm sure you agree with that.
Yep, nations grow and the nations learn from what they have historically into what they want to present both in present and future. As for the Puratan Granths, you know, Sarup Das Palla, Keir Singh, Santokh Singh, Ratan Singh, they are allowed to be wrong. It's fine. It's no different as to what we are doing now. There is no difference between a J.S. Garhiwal and a Karam Singh historian and a Kavi Santokh Singh. They are all historians. They all did their craft. They did it well to their extents. And it's exactly that. They are allowed to be wrong. But when we start looking at these sort of grunts as it is forever Gurbani and cannot be questioned, you're setting yourself up for failure.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. So I believe that at the end of the day, we need historiographers like you to not rewrite the history, but refine it, because there will be truth in there, but at least it's a truth which we can understand today while, you know, rejecting all the irrational stuff. I mean, one of the biggest things I've always had is, you know, kids who study history, Sikh history, will ask me that if Baba Deep Singh Ji fought without his head, then why does Gyani Gyan Singh mention it in the 20th century, but why doesn't Bhai Ratan Singh or, you know, even Kavi Santokh Singh mention it in the 19th century? Why doesn't someone mention it earlier? And you end up with this massive problem where you want to say something, but you don't want to offend someone's sentiments as well.
Yeah. Yep, exactly that. I remember having this conversation with a Jain who had come into the Gurdwara, and he had mentioned that. When you start sort of going on to the mystical path or sort of the semi-legendary, it leads to eventually, you run into the problem is understanding versus glorification. And you don't learn anything from a statue. You don't learn anything from a painting, right? You learn from the text. You learn from the work. You learn from the understandings then further done by others on the same text. And even for Carr's work, Carr had passed away before he could even get out a second edition of his own. And there were revisions of those done. And it's just a reality, right? That's just how things work. The glorification, it can lead to more questions than answers, really, especially for even the young diasporic Sikhs who want to get in tune with their Sikhi.
I mean, this is what I always say to them about Baba Deep Singh Ji, is that Baba Deep Singh Ji fighting and getting his head cut off wasn't the total sum of Baba Deep Singh Ji's life. Oh, yeah. It was the end of his life, but it wasn't his total life. Why don't you look at his life and how he got to this impressive stage of leadership, of being a religious scholar? Why don't you take lessons from the way he lived because you're living? Why do you always focus that, you know, Baba Deep Singh Ji was great because he fought without his head? Why not that Baba Deep Singh Ji was great because he lived Gurbani and showed us how to live like the Guru Granth Sahib wants us to live?
Yeah, that's amazing. I even if I would have wanted to put it that way, I couldn't have. And I don't think I told that Jane that either. Yeah, it's exactly that. You're right. It's the life that led him up to that point, not that point in particular, right? You need to take a look at the whole 70 plus years that he lived on this earth. And that goes on to other, of course, other figures too, right?
Well, definitely. I mean, this thing has been put among us, like, you know, General Patton told his men, it's not the bastard who dies for his country that matters. It's the bastard who makes the other bastard die for his country who matters to me. Yeah. In combat, in life, there are times when you need to make the ultimate sacrifice, but that's not really the point of your life, is it? That I'm just going to go and make the ultimate sacrifice. That's what led you up to the point and gave you strength to make that sacrifice that matters.
Yeah, definitely. It's your path, it's your knowledge. And for us as a Panth, it is this Sikhi, right? So if you really want to put it that way, is to what General Patton was saying. If it's this bastard that had written this granth and has led to some Sikhs believe this or believe that, we're shooting ourselves in the foot, because that's not the way we should grow and how growth even works as a nation, as the Sikh nation, as the Sarbat Khalsa, right?
Right. I mean, that's what I see with the historical grants. Like, you know, they now and then don't try. Either they touch on the real mystical point that if you do this, if you do that, you will get something from Vaheguru. I mean, you look at Bhakt, Tri Lochan, Shabbats in the Guru Granth Sahib, you cannot escape the consequences of your actions. Here, the Asik Granth seem to be providing us with a shortcut. Or otherwise, it's all about the sheep, the sake. And then, you know, something I've seen, especially now this is June, I mean, I grew up in the late 90s, I saw what was happening in the Punjab, was that so many of the fighters died and we went to honor them, but they achieved so less in terms of the subsequent victories, you know, after they died. And why I'm saying this is that everyone, to me, when I was younger, seemed to be in a race to die. No one seemed to be in a race to realize the fruits of those who had died earlier, you know, to build upon those victories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that comes on the basis then of seva, right? And how we're so affixated on one, that there are other means and ways that you can help the Panth grow and give benefit to the Panth. I get what you're saying there. That's actually new to me. It's an eye-opener.
I mean, if, like, I studied the life of Nawab Kapoor Singh from, you know, historical grants, the few that mention him, you know, talked with his descendants, read other books written in the 20th and 21st century. And I sort of concluded that, you know, here was a man who also tried surviving to ultimately, you know, plant a tree successfully that he knew he would never sit in its shade, but at least the Panth would have its shade. And he's actually also one of the longest lived Sikh leaders as well. He was never in a race to die or kill himself. But if there was a time when he did feel like that, he always trained a future generation of leaders, you know, made sure that they would be able to take him somewhere. So you learn so much nuance and so much political strategy from his life. But then if you present that story of Nawab Kapoor Singh from the Panth Prakashan, they will always present the same story, which is about the horses and how he was given Nawabi. You get the impression that it was all so random, like Waheguru willed it. And then you sit down and decide, well, you know what? I'm not going to do anything myself. Waheguru will provide us another Nawab Kapoor Singh. Except Nawab Kapoor Singh's mission was that, you know, I am Nawab Kapoor Singh, but you're also Nawab Kapoor Singh. You're also Nawab Kapoor Singh. You're also Nawab Kapoor Singh. After I die, there should be an army of Nawab Kapoor Singhs ready to replace me.
That is the growth. That is the growth of the Sikh nation, the Sarbat Khalsa. We can't just sit around in limbo and even want to say if something's going to happen eventually, it's going to happen and it will come through. I've heard this time. If it's not happening, it's hook 'em, right? There's sort of the sort of lens there. And that's just not the reality. That's just not how even things work. That's just not how the bunt works, right? And you mentioned the analogy of Jetsadar Nawab Kapoor Singh. And it's exactly that. He came in as a character. And like you said, a lot of the things that you mentioned as that we know is fact of Nawab Kapoor Singh comes from historical studies that have been done after these grunts have come out. So it's just that. It's exactly that. We as our own individuals want to keep this tree growing, keep this tree healthy so that even we are not in the shade. I'm not sure what kind of analogy I'm trying to say here, but what I'm trying to say is that it's up to us, right? And we are in a better position, right? As even Carr had mentioned too, and just what his history is, even his introduction is, we are in a better position now. It is arguable. There's this paradox I was thinking about even earlier. We might even know Sikhi now than we could have said in 1750, in 1850, right?
Yep.
And it's definitely that paradox. It's that paradox. But then you come back to people saying, oh no, the Puratan Granth may say this and that was closer. And it's arguable from each side. But I really, just looking at everything, looking through historiography, I really think that it's the former. We're in a better spot now.
Well, obviously, I mean, you imagine if you were a warrior back then, you know, you woke up, you tied your banner, you put on your armor, you had your 5Ks, you went out to fight and you died. Today, we have the Guru Granth Sahib lying there for us in the Gurdwaras. How many of us are going to go read it? And, you know, especially given the fact our forefathers died just to, you know, even be allowed to have a Gurdwara in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. That's a really heavy thought that always comes into my mind. It's that, and I hope it's definitely for other Gurmukhs too. It's that just think about how many lives were given for us to get here. And how it would have continued even on to these eras that in which these grunts were being produced. There were still these sapahis, right? These Singhs and Singhnia were out there and living that life so that they would have done that. And so now we're here in that position. Let's continue the same as to looking through our history.
I mean, I won't mention his name. I have a friend in Denmark who's a historian. He's probably written 200 articles on the Shri Gur Panth Prakash. Now, if the Panth Prakash was a cow, it would be a pretty emaciated cow because my friend would have milked the last damn drop of blood out of that cow. His entire career is built on the Shri Gur Panth Prakash, the economies of Shri Gur Panth Prakash, the economics of Shri Gur Panth Prakash, the finance of Shri Gur Panth Prakash. And one day he rang me and he said, do you want to read my new article? And I asked him, well, what is that? Oh, the economies of the weaponry systems of the Shri Gur Panth Prakash. And
wow.
I was blown away and I asked him, like, I told him, you know, you shouldn't be like a historian specializing in Sikh history. We should just give you the title of, you know, Dr. So-and-so specializing in the Shri Gur Panth Prakash. Anyway, he felt pretty insulted after that. But another thing which comes to mind here is that surely there must be more Granths out there, more historical manuscripts waiting to be found all over the subcontinent.
Yeah, definitely. And it's kind of sad that, especially we're talking about it now in the first week of June, that, you know, coming to my mind right now, it's the burning of the Sikh reference library by the Indian Army. We lost a lot there. And but nevertheless, you know, we're finding these sort of things still around in different repositories and archives. I mean, I think just recently, just really even, I want to say in the past 5 years, there was a university in, I want to say Denmark again, that had a really, really old Puratan handwritten sarup entirely, Larivar of Guru Granth Sahib, and just flipped open at a random ang and just sitting there in the library. And it was up until now that that point, I would say, that Sangat had not come across it. And then some sort of outrage was put up against the university that, hey, you cannot have this really old Puratan Sarup like that. Even if you are to hold on to it, it cannot be in the way that it is just in display in a library like that. I don't know what the consequences or the result of that was. I've never followed up on it. But it's definitely possible that these sort of things can still be around and just being here. And there's absolutely no mean as to why we can't pull something out and critique that and put it up against what we already have.
Definitely, because I remember in New Zealand 10 years ago, I believe they actually had a sword in a museum in the South Island. Indian soldiers' sword. It was a really regal royal sword until a Gora historian decided to study these swords. And ultimately, they discovered that this sword was actually, I believe, used in the Battle of Nodan by none other than Guru Gobind Singh Ji himself.
Wow, that's impressive. Quick note, want to compare that to how there has been some claims of, it might be the India Kal Takht Dosh Khanna, could be Sri Anandpur Sahib too, where there's sometimes there's this picture that's circulated I don't remember if it's a double-edged sword, but it's said to be the sword of Ali. Yes, yeah. Sword of Ali, which was gifted by then Emperor Bahadur Shah to Guru Gobind Singh. Whereas that sword most likely probably is not. I really don't want to believe that.
Oh, no, definitely. Personally, I don't even believe that myself. I mean, lots of research needs to be provided. Anyhow, what advice would you have for younger Sikhs today if they want to follow in your path into historiography?
It goes back to Gurmat, right? It goes back to what Guru Nanak was always saying, is just question everything. Use logic. Question, right? What are we looking at? What do we have here? What is being put forward to us as a pant as a whole? What are we looking at? What are we digesting? And then why, right? So exactly in terms of this historiography, right? This studying these methods that which historians have used to develop history in academia in particular, is that it's your question and know that what I had mentioned earlier, we are in a better spot now than what we would have been previously. And we are is still in a position to grow. And we are also always in a position to challenge and learn. And it doesn't even need to be so that the challenge is then proven right. You could still be proven wrong. It's fine. But know that the history that we have right now, know that the history that's being given to us, and especially through these Puratan Granths and whatnot, these older, really much older texts, that they are allowed to be critiqued. They are historians too, right? They are normal. They are normal human beings of the panth, and just trying to get our own understanding as to what they would have had in that time. And speaking of that time, we are now allowed to look at the understanding of the panth in our time.
Definitely. I mean, if you look at works like Herodotus, when they actually brought these out in the early 20th century, late 19th century. All the works of ancient Greeks and Romans, they cut out all the crap and they just kept all the accurate details. And these were the works which were actually read solely in military academies and, you know, especially given to boys with adventuresome streak. And these works found themselves in the hands of, you know, Dwight Eisenhower, George Patton, Winston Churchill, Roosevelt. And ultimately these works, because they were so refined, they provided the incentive for these men to actually, you know, just jump into World War II. And I want to say the F word, but, you know, they just F'd the enemy straight away because they had this inspiration behind them from history. And we can do the same ourselves as long as we are able to refine our narratives.
Yep. You mentioned that the military schools, that's exactly what would have been being done during Baba Deep Singh's time, right? And you're in the position to, F and go on and do these sort of things. And we all as a collective bunt, not only are we allowed to do it, we can do it. So there really shouldn't be anything in our path.
I mean, think about it. The intellectualism of Guru Nanak finally produced the Guru Gobind Singh who wielded his sword. Right? Mm-hmm. So our intellectuals, our academics have a sacred duty towards our future generations because they will be the ones shaping the future warriors and preachers.
It's exactly that. It's what's written that goes on to give us that sort of power, right? I just made this analogy and I'd connected the dots. Right, we know Guru Gobind Singh asking for five heads, right, at Sri Anandpur Sahib. Why? Well, Guru Nanak had said, right, if you want to play this game of love with me, give me your head, right?
Yep, definitely. And you know, Guru Gobind Singh Ji also asked for books because Guru Maharaj knew the value of a book, the written word. The Guru Granth Sahib is the Pandra Pakht, the Guru's, the, you know, Gursikhs, the Pats, talking to us across from 4 to 5 centuries, maybe even longer, because we don't know, we don't have accurate details of the Pats' lives. Mm-hmm. All these other works we have are those people talking to us from across the generations. So we need that, you know, reading power today in our Pant again as well, and only our academics can provide those. Any last words? Any mistakes we made?
Definitely the good old pull took them off for anything misspoken or anyone had taken any rubbed anyone in a different kind of way. I believe these conversations are important, as what we've been focused on is the growth of the Panth, right? We're allowed to discuss things like these. We're allowed to critique. We're allowed to challenge. We're allowed to be proven right or we're proven wrong, right? We are a nation together, and it's us that's going to keep us standing and going forward.
Definitely. Thank you very much for joining us today. We are indebted to you, and we hope you keep on coming back and back. You're one of our popular guests.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. Both shukranda.
Thank you. Waheguru Ji Ka Khalsa, Waheguru Ji Ki Fateh. Until next time.
Waheguru Ji Ka Khalsa, Waheguru Ji Ki Fateh.